It was along that stretch that General Michel had planned to defend France. Joffre found his plan in the office safe when he succeeded Michel. It concentrated the center of gravity of the French forces to this extreme left section of the line, where Joffre left none. It was a plan of pure defense. It allowed for no seizing of initiative. It was, as Joffre decided after careful study, foolishness. The French General Staff, though receiving many indications collected by the Deuxième Bureau, or military intelligence, pointing to a powerful German right-wing envelopment, believed the arguments against such a manoeuvre more telling than the evidence for it. They did not credit the sweep through Flanders, although in fact they had been told about it in a dramatic manner by an officer of the German General Staff, who in 1904 betrayed to them an early version of the Schlieffen Plan. In a series of three rendezvous with a French intelligence officer at Brussels, Paris and Nice, the German appeared with his head swathed in bandages, revealing only a grey moustache and a pair of piercing eyes. The documents he handed over, for a considerable sum, revealed that the Germans planned to come through Belgium by way of Liège, Namur, Charleroi, and invade France along the valley of the Oise by way of Guise, Noyon and Compiègne. The route was correct for 1914, for the documents were authentic. General Pendezac, then chief of the French General Staff, believed the information fitted perfectly with the present tendency of German strategy, which teaches the necessity of wide envelopment. But many of his colleagues were doubtful. They did not believe the Germans could mobilize enough men to maneuver on such a scale, and they suspected the information might be a feint, designed to draw the French away from the area of the real attack. French planning was hampered by a variety of uncertainties, and the greatest of these was Belgium. To the logical French mind, it seemed obvious that the Germans would bring England in against them if they violated Belgium and attacked Antwerp. Was it likely the Germans would deliberately do themselves this disservice? Rather, was it not altogether likely that leaving Belgium unviolated, they would return to the elder Moltke's plan of attacking Russia first, before the slow Russian mobilization could be completed? Attempting to fit Plan 17 to one of several hypotheses of German strategy, Joffre and Castelnau believed that the most likely one was a major enemy offensive across the plateau of Lorraine. They expected it to violate the corner of Belgium east of the Meuse. They calculated German strength on the Western Front, without use of reserves in the front line, at 26 corps. For this number to be extended in strength on the far side of the Meuse was impossible, decided Castelnau. I was of the same opinion, agreed Joffre. Jean Jaurès, the great socialist leader, thought differently. Leading the fight against the three-year law, he insisted in his speeches and in his book L'Armée Nouvelle that the war of the future would be one of mass armies using every citizen, that this was what the Germans were preparing, that reservists of 25 to 33 were at their peak of stamina and more committed than younger men without responsibilities, that unless France used all her reservists in the front line, she would be subjected to a terrible submersion. Outside the chapel of Plan 17, there were still military critics who argued strongly for the defensive. Colonel Grouard, in his book La Guerre Eventuelle, published in 1913, wrote, "It is, above all, the German offensive through Belgium on which we ought to fix our attention. As far as one can foresee the logical consequences of the opening of our campaign, we can say without hesitation that if we take the offensive at the outset, we shall be beaten. But if France prepared a riposte against the German right wing, all the chances are in our favour." In 1913, the Deuxième Bureau collected enough information on the German use of reserves as active troops as to make it impossible for the French General Staff to be ignorant of this crucial factor. A critique by Moltke on German manoeuvres of 1913, indicating that the reserves would be so used, came into French possession. Major Melotte, Belgian military attaché in Berlin, noticed and reported the Germans calling up an unusual number of reserves in 1913, from which he concluded that they were forming a reserve corps for every active corps. But the authors of Plan 17 did not want to be convinced. They rejected evidence that argued in favour of their staying on the defensive, because their hearts and hopes, as well as their training and strategy, were fixed on the offensive. They persuaded themselves that the Germans intended to use reserve units only to guard communication lines and passive fronts, and as siege and occupation troops. They enabled themselves to reject defense of the Belgian frontier by insisting that if the Germans extended their right wing as far as Flanders, they would leave their center so thinned that the French, as Castelnau said, could cut them in half. A strong German right wing would give the French advantage of superior numbers against the German center and left. This was the meaning of Castelnau's classic phrase, "So much the better for us." When General Lebar, on that occasion, left the Rue Saint-Dominique, he said to the deputy from Lille who had accompanied him, "I have two stars on my sleeve and he has three. How can I argue?" Chapter 4. A Single British Soldier. Britain's joint military plans with France were begotten in 1905, when Russia's far-off defeats at the hands of the Japanese, revealing her military impotence, unhinged the equilibrium of Europe. Suddenly and simultaneously, the government of every nation became aware that if any one of them chose that moment to precipitate a war, France would have to fight without an ally. The German government put the moment to an immediate test. Within 3 weeks of the Russian defeat at Mukden in 1905, a challenge was flung at France in the form of the Kaiser's sensational appearance at Tangier on March 31. To Frenchmen, it meant that Germany was probing for the moment of again and would find it, if not now, then soon. "Like everyone else, I had come to Paris at 9 o'clock on that morning," wrote Charles Péguy, the poet, editor, mystic, socialist against his party and Catholic against his church, who spoke, as nearly as one person could, for the conscience of France. "Like everyone else, I knew at 11:30 that in the space of those 2 hours a new period had begun in the history of my life, in the history of this country, in the history of the world." Of his own life, Péguy was not speaking vainly. In August 1914, he was to volunteer at 41 for military service and be killed in action at the Marne on September 7. Britain, too, reacted to the challenge of Tangier. Her military establishment was just then being thoroughly overhauled by Lord Esher's committee. It included, besides himself, the turbulent First Sea Lord, Sir John Fisher, who had been reforming the Navy by a series of explosions, and an army officer, Sir George Clark, known for his modern ideas on imperial strategy. The Esher triumvirate had created a Committee of Imperial Defence to govern policy pertaining to war, of which Esher was permanent member and Clark was secretary, and had endowed the army with a pristine general staff. Just at the time when the Kaiser was nervously riding a two-spirited white horse through the streets of Tangier, the staff was engaged in a theoretical war game based on the assumption that the Germans would come through Belgium in a wide flanking movement north and west of the Meuse. The map exercise proved to the Director of Military Operations, General Grierson, and to his assistant, General Robertson, that there was little chance of stopping the Germans unless British forces arrived on the scene quickly and in strength. At that time, independent action in Belgium was what the British contemplated. Mr. Balfour, the Conservative Prime Minister, at once asked for a report on how soon a force of 4 divisions could be mobilized and landed in Belgium in the event of a German invasion. In the midst of a crisis, while Grierson and Robertson were over on the continent, examining the terrain along the Franco-Belgian frontier, Balfour's government lost office. Nerves on all sides were stretched tight in the expectation that Germany might take advantage of Russia's catastrophe to precipitate war in the coming summer. No plans for common Anglo-French military action had yet been made. With Britain in the throes of a general election and ministers scattered about the country campaigning, the French were forced to make an unofficial approach. Their military attaché in London, Major Huguet, made contact with an active and eager intermediary, Colonel Repington, military correspondent of the Times, who, with a nod from Esher and Clark, opened negotiations. In a memorandum submitted to the French government, Colonel Repington asked, May we take it as a principle that France will not violate Belgian territory unless compelled to do so by previous violation by Germany? Definitely yes, the French replied. Do the French realize, asked the colonel, intending to convey a warning as well as a prognosis, that any violation of Belgian neutrality brings us into the field automatically in defense of our treaty obligations? No British government in history ever committed itself to take action automatically upon an event, but the colonel, with the bit in his teeth, was galloping far ahead of the field. France has always supposed so, was the somewhat dazed answer, but has never received an official assurance. By further leading questions, the colonel established that France did not think highly of independent British action in Belgium and believed that unity of command, for France on land and Britain at sea, was absolutely indispensable. Meanwhile, the Liberals had been elected. Traditionally opposed to war and foreign adventure, they were confident that good intentions could keep the peace. Their new Foreign Secretary was Sir Edward Grey, who suffered the death of his wife a month after taking office. Their new Secretary for War was a barrister with a passion for German philosophy, Richard Haldane, who, when asked by the soldiers in council what kind of army he had in mind, replied, "A Hegelian army." The conversation then fell off, he recorded. Grey, warily approached by the French, indicated he had no intention of receding from any assurances his predecessor had given to France. Faced with a major crisis in his first week of office, he asked Haldane if arrangements existed for the British to fight alongside the French in the event of an emergency. Haldane looked in the files and found none. His inquiry disclosed that to put four divisions on the continent would take 2 months. Grey wondered if talks between the general staffs might not now take place as a military precaution without committing Great Britain. Haldane consulted the Prime Minister, Sir Henry Campbell Bannerman. Despite party affiliation, Campbell Bannerman was personally so fond of things French that he would sometimes take the Channel steamer over and back in one day in order to lunch at Calais. He gave his assent to staff talks, though with some misgivings about the stress laid on joint preparations. He thought that coming as they did, very close to an honourable understanding, they might destroy the lovely looseness of the Entente. To avoid any such unpleasantness, Haldane arranged for a letter to be signed by General Grierson and Major Huguet, stating that the talks did not commit Great Britain. With this formula safely established, he authorized the talks to begin. Thereupon he, Grey, and the Prime Minister, without informing the rest of the cabinet, left further developments in the hands of the military as a departmental affair. From here, the general staffs took over. British officers, including Sir John French, a cavalry general who had made a great name in the Boer War, attended the French manoeuvres that summer. Grierson and Robertson revisited the frontier in company with Major Huguet. In consultation with the French general staff, they selected landing bases and staging areas along a front from Charleroi to Namur and into the Ardennes, predicated on a German invasion through Belgium. The Escher Triumvirate, however, fundamentally disapproved of employing the British Army as a mere adjunct of the French, and after the tension of the Moroccan crisis relaxed, the joint planning begun in 1905 was not pushed further. General Grierson was replaced. The dominant view, represented by Lord Escher, favoured action independent of French command in Belgium, where the holding of Antwerp and the adjoining coast was a direct British interest. In the vehement opinion of Sir John Fisher, British action ought to be predominantly naval. He doubted the military capacity of the French, expected the Germans to beat them on land, and saw no purpose in ferrying the British army over to be included in that defeat. The only land action he favoured was an audacious leap onto Germany's back, and he had chosen the exact spot, a 10-mile stretch of hard sand along the Baltic coast of East Prussia. Here, only 90 miles from Berlin, the nearest point to the German capital that could be reached by sea, British troops landed by the Navy could seize and entrench a base of operations and keep 1 million Germans busy. Apart from this action, the army should be absolutely restricted to sudden descents upon the coast, the recovery of Heligoland, and the garrisoning of Antwerp. its plan to fight in France was, in Fisher's opinion, suicidal idiocy. The War Office was remarkable for its ignorance of war, and the army should be administered as an annex to the navy. Early in 1910, Fisher, at 69, was simultaneously raised to the peerage and relieved of the Admiralty, but that was to be far from the end of his usefulness. After the emergency of 1905 to 1906 had passed, joint military plans with the French made little progress for the next few years. In the interim, two men formed a trans-channel friendship, which was to serve as the first cable for the building of a bridge. Britain's Staff College was then commanded by Brigadier General Henry Wilson, a tall, bony, ebullient Anglo-Irishman, with a face which he thought rather resembled that of a horse. Quick and impatient, Wilson was in a constant boil of ideas, humour, passion, imagination, and above all, energy. When serving at the War Office in London, he used to trot around Hyde Park for exercise before breakfast, carrying with him the morning paper to read whenever he slowed down to a walk. Brought up by a succession of French governesses, he could speak French fluently. He was less interested in German. In January 1909, Schlieffen published an anonymous article in the Deutsche Revue to protest certain changes made in his plan by his successor Moltke. The basic outline, if not the details, of the colossal canny prepared for the envelopment of the French and British armies was revealed, and the identity of the author surmised. When a student at Camberley brought the article to the Commandant's attention, Wilson returned it with a casual comment, "Very interesting." In December 1909, General Wilson took it into his head to visit his opposite number, the commandant of the École Supérieure de la Guerre, General Foch. He attended four lectures and a seminar, and was politely invited to tea by General Foch, who, though impatient with the interruptions of distinguished visitors, felt he owed this much to his British counterpart. General Wilson, enthusiastic at what he had seen and heard, stayed for 3 hours' talk. When Foch was finally able to escort his visitor to the door and made what he thought were his final goodbyes, Wilson happily announced that he was returning next day to continue the conversation and see more of the curriculum. Foch could not but admire the Englishman's calm and be pleased by his interest. Their second talk opened their minds to each other. Within a month, Wilson was back in Paris for another session. Foch accepted his invitation to come to London in the spring, and Wilson agreed to return for the French staff tour in the summer. In London, when Foch came over, Wilson introduced him to Haldane and others at the War Office. Bursting into the room of one of his colleagues, he said, "I've got a French general outside, General Foch. Mark my words, this fellow's going to command the Allied armies when the big war comes on." Here, Wilson had already accepted the principle of unity of command and picked the man for it, although it was to take 4 years of war and the brink of defeat before events would bear him out. During repeated visits after 1909, the two commandants became fast friends, even to the extent of Wilson being admitted into the French family circle and invited to the wedding of Foch's daughter. With his friend Henri, Foch spent hours in what an observer called tremendous gossips. They used to exchange caps and walk up and down together, the short and the tall, arguing and chaffing. Wilson had been particularly impressed by the rush and dash with which studies were conducted at the War College. Officer instructors constantly urged on officer pupils with "vite, vite" and "allez, allez." Introduced to the classes in the Camberley Staff College, the hurry-up technique was quickly dubbed Wilson's "allez" operations. A question that Wilson asked of Foch during his second visit in January 1910 evoked an answer which expressed in one sentence the problem of the alliance with England as the French saw it. "What is the smallest British military force that would be of any practical assistance to you?" Wilson asked. Like a rapier flash came Foch's reply, "A single British soldier, and we will see to it that he is killed." Wilson, too, wanted to see Britain committed, convinced that war with Germany was imminent and inevitable. He strove to infuse his own sense of urgency into his colleagues and pupils, and himself became totally absorbed by it. In August 1910 came his opportunity. He was named Director of Military Operations, the post from which General Grierson had originated the staff talks with France. When Major Huguet at once came to see the new director to bewail a lack of progress since 1906 on the important question of Anglo-French military cooperation, Wilson replied, "Important question? But it is vital. There is no other." Immediately, the joint planning took on new impetus. Wilson could see nothing, go nowhere but France and Belgium. On his first visit in 1909, he'd spent 10 days by train and bicycle touring the Franco-Belgian and Franco-German frontier from Valenciennes to Belfort. He had found that Foch's appreciation of the German move through Belgium is exactly the same as mine, the important line being between Verdun and Namur. In other words, east of the Meuse. During the next 4 years, he repeated his visits 3 and 4 times a year, each time making bicycle or motor tours of the old battlefields of 1870 and of anticipated future battlefields in Lorraine and the Ardennes. On each visit, he conferred with Foch, and after Foch's departure, with Joffre, Castelnau, Dubai, and others of the French general staff. Covering the whole wall of Wilson's room in the War Office was a huge map of Belgium, with every road by which he thought the Germans could march marked in heavy black. When he came to the War Office, Wilson found that under the new order, wrote by Schopenhauer among the generals, as Haldane was called, the regular army had been thoroughly trained, prepared, and organized to become an expeditionary force at a moment's need, with all arrangements completed to bring it up to war strength upon mobilization day. But of plans to transport it across the Channel, billet it, feed it, move it up to concentration areas in France, align it with the French armies, there were none. What he felt to be the lethargy of the staff on this subject sent Wilson into periodic paroxysms of vexation, recorded in his diary. "There it is, satisfied. No rail arrangements, no arrangements for horse supply, a scandalous state of affairs. No train arrangements to port, no staff arrangements to port, no naval arrangements, absolutely no medical arrangements, horse difficulty has not been solved, absolutely nothing exists, which is scandalous. Unpreparedness disgraceful. Horse question in disgraceful state." Yet by March 1911, out of all this lack of arrangements and of horses, he had brought a schedule of mobilization by which the whole of the infantry of 6 divisions would embark on the 4th day, cavalry 7th day, artillery 9th day. It was just in time. On July 1, 1911, the Panther came to Agadir. Through all the chancelleries of Europe ran the whispered monosyllable, "War." Wilson hurried over to Paris in the same month that the French War Council, ousting General Michel, turned its back forever on the defensive. Together with General Dubai, he drew up a memorandum providing, in the event of British intervention, for an expeditionary force of 6 regular divisions and a cavalry division. Signed by Wilson and Dubai on July 20, it specified a total force of 150,000 men and 67,000 horses, which were to land at Havre, Boulogne, and upriver at Rouen between the 4th and 12th days of mobilization, to proceed by rail to a concentration area in the Maubeuge region, and to be ready for action on M13. In effect, the Dubai-Wilson Agreement attached the British Army, in the event that war came and Britain entered it, to the French, placing it where it would prolong the French line and guard the French flank against envelopment. It meant, as Major Huguet gladly recorded, that the French had persuaded Wilson and the British General Staff against a secondary theatre of operations and in favour of common action in the main theatre, that is to say, the French. In fact, the British Navy was as much responsible as the French, because its refusal to guarantee disembarkation ports above the line Dover to Calais precluded landings closer to or within Belgium. Upon Wilson's return to London, the question of the hour, he wrote in his diary, was whether Germany would go to war with France and us. Consulted by Grey and Haldane over lunch, he presented an emphatic 3-point program. First, we must join the French. Second, we must mobilize the same day as the French. Third, we must send all 6 divisions. He felt profoundly dissatisfied with the two civilians' grasp of the situation, but he was at once given a further opportunity to instruct the government in the facts of war. On August 23, Prime Minister Asquith, Campbell Bannerman's successor since 1908, convened a secret and special meeting of the Imperial Defence Committee to clarify British strategy in case of war. It lasted all day, with General Wilson expounding the army view in the morning and Fisher's successor, Admiral Sir Arthur Wilson, presenting the Navy's view in the afternoon. Besides Asquith, Grey and Haldane, three other cabinet members were present: the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, the First Lord of the Admiralty, Mr. McKenna, and the Home Secretary, a young man of 37, impossible to ignore, who from his inappropriate post had pelted the Prime Minister during the crisis with ideas on naval and military strategy, all of them quite sound, had produced an astonishingly accurate prediction of the future course of the fighting, and who had no doubts whatever about what needed to be done. The Home Secretary was Winston Churchill. Wilson, facing this group of ignorant men, as he called them, and accompanied by his fellow officer and future chief, Sir John French, who knows nothing at all about the subject, pinned up his great map of Belgium on the wall and lectured for 2 hours. He swept away many illusions when he explained how Germany, counting on Russia's slow mobilization, would send the bulk of her forces against the French, achieving superiority of numbers over them. He correctly predicated the German plan of attack upon a right-wing envelopment, but schooled in the French theories, estimated the force that would come down west of the Meuse at no more than 4 divisions. He stated that if all 6 British divisions were sent immediately upon the outbreak of war to the extreme left of the French line, the chances of stopping the Germans would be favourable. When the Admiral's turn came in the afternoon, the dazed civilians were astonished to discover that the Navy's plan had nothing in common with the Army's. He proposed to land the expeditionary force not in France, but on that 10-mile strip of hard sand upon the northern shore of Prussia, where it would draw off more than its weight of numbers from the German fighting line. His argument was violently combated by the generals. The absence of Lord Fisher nerved Asquith to reject it, and the army carried the day. Fisher's growls of disgust erupted periodically thereafter. "The overwhelming supremacy of the British Navy is the only thing to keep the German army out of Paris," he wrote to a friend some months later. "Our soldiers are grotesque in their absurd ideas of war, but happily they are powerless. It is Antwerp we shall seize and not go fooling on the Vosges frontier." A certain inescapable logic in the Antwerp idea was to keep tugging at British military plans up to the last minute in 1914 and even afterward. The meeting of August 1911, like that of the French War Council which had disposed of General Michel a few weeks earlier, was decisive upon British strategy, and it had a decisive byproduct. A shake-up in the policy-making posts of the Navy being decreed, the eager Home Secretary was happily translated into First Lord of the Admiralty, where in 1914 he was to prove indispensable. Echoes of the secret meeting of the CID angered the cabinet members who had been left out and who belonged to the sternly pacifist wing of the party. Henry Wilson learned that he was regarded as the villain of the proceedings and that they are calling for my head. At this time began the split in the cabinet which was to be so critical in the ultimate days of decision. The government maintained the disingenuous position that the military conversations were, in Haldane's words, "just the natural and informal outcome of our close friendship with France." Natural outcome they might be, informal they were not. As Lord Esher, with a certain realism, said to the Prime Minister, "the plans worked out jointly by the General Staffs have certainly committed us to fight, whether the Cabinet likes it or not." There is no record what Asquith replied, or what, in his inmost mind, a region difficult to penetrate under the best of circumstances, he thought on this crucial question. In the following year, 1912, a naval agreement was reached with France as the result of a momentous mission, not to France, but to Berlin. In an effort to dissuade the Germans from passing a new naval law providing for increases in the fleet, Haldane was sent to talk with the Kaiser, Bethmann Hollweg, Admiral Tirpitz, and other German leaders. It was the last Anglo-German attempt to find a common ground of understanding, and it failed. As a quid pro quo for keeping their fleet second to Britain's, the Germans demanded a promise of British neutrality in the event of war between Germany and France. This the British refused to give. Haldane returned, convinced that Germany's drive for hegemony in Europe would have to be resisted sooner or later. "I thought, from my study of the German general staff, that once the German war party had got into the saddle, it would be war not merely for the overthrow of France or Russia, but for the domination of the world." Coming from Haldane, this conclusion had a profound effect upon liberal thinking and planning. The first result was a naval pact with France, by which the British undertook, at threat of war, to safeguard the Channel and French coast from enemy attack, leaving the French fleet to concentrate in the Mediterranean. As this disposed the French fleet where it would not otherwise be except by virtue of the agreement, it left a distinct obligation upon Britain. Although the terms of the agreement were not known to the cabinet as a whole, an uneasy sense prevailed that matters had gone too far. Not satisfied with the no-commitment formula, the anti-war group insisted that it be put in writing. Sir Edward Grey obliged in the form of a letter to Monsieur Cambon, the French ambassador. Drafted and approved by the cabinet, it was a masterpiece of ellipsis. The military conversations, it said, left both parties free to decide at any future time whether or not to assist each other by armed force. The naval agreement was not based upon an engagement to cooperate in war. At threat of war, both parties would take into consideration the plans of their general staffs and then decide what effect should be given them. This curious document managed to satisfy everybody. The French, because the whole British cabinet government had now officially acknowledged the existence of the joint plans, the anti-war group, because it said England was not committed, and Grey, because he had evolved a formula that both saved the plans and quieted their opponents. To have substituted a definite alliance with France, as he was urged in some quarters, would break up the cabinet, he said. After Agadir, as each year brought its summer crisis and the air grew heavier with approaching storm, the joint work of the general staff grew more intense. Sir Henry Wilson's tours abroad grew more frequent. He found the new French chief, General Joffre, a fine, manly, imperturbable soldier with much character and determination, and Castelnau very clever and intelligent. He continued his surveys of the Belgian frontier, cycling back and forth over the various roads, and returning always to his favourite battlefield of 1870 at Mars-la-Tour near Metz, where each time he saw the statue France commemorating the battle, he felt a pang. On one visit, he recorded, "I laid at her feet a small bit of map I'd been carrying, showing the areas of concentration of the British forces on her territory." In 1912, he examined the new German railway constructions, all converging on Aachen and the Belgian frontier. In February of that year, Anglo-French plans had reached the point where Joffre could tell the Supreme War Council that he counted on the British for 6 infantry divisions and on 1 cavalry division and 2 mounted brigades, totaling 145,000 men. L'armée W, as in tribute to Wilson the force was designated by the French, would land at Boulogne, Havre and Rouen, concentrate in the Hirson-Maubeuge region and be ready for action on the 15th day of mobilization. Later, in 1912, Wilson attended autumn manoeuvres with Joffre and Castelnau and the Grand Duke Nicholas of Russia, and afterward went on to Russia for talks with the Russian General Staff. In 1913, he visited Paris every other month to confer with the French staff chiefs and to join the manoeuvres of Foch's 20th Corps guarding the frontier. While Wilson was tightening and perfecting his arrangements with the French, Britain's new Chief of Imperial General Staff, Sir John French, made an attempt in 1912 to revert to the idea of independent action in Belgium. Discreet inquiries made by the British military attaché in Brussels put an end to this effort. The Belgians were discovered to be adamant in the strict observance of their own neutrality. When the British attaché asked about possible joint arrangements for British landings in Belgium on the premise of a prior German violation, he was informed that the British would have to wait until their military assistance was requested. The British minister, making his own inquiries, was told that if British troops landed before a German invasion or without a formal Belgian request, the Belgians would open fire. Belgium's rigid purity confirmed what the British never tired of repeating to the French, that everything depended upon the Germans violating Belgian neutrality first. Never, no matter on what pretext, Lord Escher cautioned Major Huguet in 1911, let the French commanders be led into being the first to cross the Belgian frontier. If they did, England could never be on their side. If the Germans did, they would bring England in against them. Monsieur Cambon, the French ambassador in London, expressed the condition the other way around. Only if Germany violated Belgium, was the burden of his dispatches, could France be sure of Britain's support. By the spring of 1914, the joint work of the French and British general staffs was complete to the last billet of every battalion, even to the places where they were to drink their coffee. The number of French railroad cars to be allotted, the assignments of interpreters, the preparation of codes and ciphers, the forage of horses was settled or expected to be consummated by July. The fact that Wilson and his staff were in constant communication with the French had to be concealed. All the work on Plan W, as the movement of the expeditionary force was called by both staffs, was done in utmost secrecy, confined to half a dozen officers alone, who did even the typing, filing, and clerical work. While the military pre-arranged the lines of battle, England's political leaders, pulling the blanket of no commitment over their heads, resolutely refrained from watching them. Chapter 5. The Russian Steamroller. The Russian Colossus exercised a spell upon Europe. On the chessboard of military planning, Russia's size and weight of numbers represented the largest piece. Notwithstanding her shoddy performance in the war against Japan, thought of the Russian steamroller gave comfort and encouragement to France and Britain. Dread of the Slav at their backs haunted the Germans. Although the defects of the Russian army were notorious, although the Russian winter, not the Russian army, had turned Napoleon back from Moscow, although it had been defeated on its own soil by the French and British in the Crimea, although the Turks in 1877 had outfought it at the Siege of Plevna and only succumbed later to overwhelming numbers, although the Japanese had outfought it in Manchuria, a myth of its invincibility prevailed. The savage cavalry charge of yelling Cossacks was such a fixture in European minds that newspaper artists in August 1914 were able to draw it in stirring detail without having been within 1,000 miles of the Russian front. Cossacks and inexhaustible millions of hardy, uncomplaining mujiks willing to die made up the stereotype of the Russian army. Its numbers inspired awe. 1,423,000 in peacetime strength, an additional 3,115,000 to be called upon mobilization, and a further reserve of 2 million in territorials and recruits to make a total available force of 6.5 million. It was envisaged as a gigantic mass, initially lethargic, but once thoroughly roused into motion, rolling forward inexorably with, no matter how many losses, endless waves of manpower to fill the places of the fallen. The army's efforts to purge incompetence and corruption since the war with Japan were believed to have brought improvement. Everyone in French politics was immensely impressed by the growing strength of Russia and her tremendous resources and potential power and wealth, Sir Edward Grey noticed when he was in Paris in April 1914 to negotiate a naval agreement with the Russians. He shared the impression himself. Russian resources are so great, he told President Poincaré, that in the long run Germany will be exhausted without our helping Russia. To the French, the success of Plan 17, the irresistible march to the Rhine, was to be the proving of their nation and one of the great moments of European history. To ensure their breakthrough of the German centre, they were bent on having the Russians draw off a portion of the German forces opposing them. The problem was to get Russia to launch an offensive upon Germany's rear at the same time as the Germans and French launched theirs on the Western Front. That is, as nearly as possible, to the 15th day of mobilization. The French knew as well as everyone else that it was physically impossible for Russia to complete mobilization and concentration of her forces in 15 days, but they wanted her to begin battle on M15 with whatever she had ready. They were determined that Germany must be forced to fight on two fronts from the first moment in order to reduce the German superiority in numbers against themselves. In 1911, General Dubai, then chief of the War Ministry staff, was sent to Russia to indoctrinate the Russian general staff with the need for seizing the initiative. Although half the Russian forces in a European war would be concentrated against Austria, and only half of those destined to take the field against Germany would be ready by M15, the spirit in St. Petersburg was bold and willing. Anxious to restore glory to their tarnished arms, and leaving details of planning to look after themselves, the Russians agreed, with more valour than discretion, to launch an offensive simultaneously with France. Dubai obtained a promise that as soon as their frontline forces were in position, without waiting for concentration to be completed, the Russians would attack, crossing the frontier of East Prussia on M16. "It is at the very heart of Germany that we should strike," acknowledged the Tsar in a signed agreement. "The objective for both of us ought to be Berlin." The pact for an early Russian offensive was hardened and sharpened in annual staff talks that were a feature of the Franco-Russian alliance. In 1912, General Jilinski, chief of the Russian general staff, came to Paris. In 1913, General Joffre went to Russia. By now, the Russians had succumbed to the spell of élan. Since Manchuria, they too had to compensate for the humiliation of military defeat and the consciousness of military deficiencies. Colonel Grimazon's lectures, translated into Russian, enjoyed immense popularity. Suffused with the glittering doctrine of offensive à outrance, the Russian general staff improved on its promises. General Jilinski undertook in 1912 to have all of the 800,000 men destined for the German front ready by M15, although Russia's railways were manifestly inadequate to the task. In 1913, he advanced the date of his offensive by 2 days, although Russia's armament factories were producing less than two-thirds the estimated need of artillery shells and less than half the need of rifle cartridges. The Allies did not seriously concern themselves with Russia's military defects, although Ian Hamilton, Britain's military observer with the Japanese, had reported them pitilessly from Manchuria. They were poor intelligence, disregard of cover, disregard of secrecy and swiftness, lack of dash, lack of initiative, and lack of good generalship. Colonel Repington, who had pronounced judgment weakly on the Russo-Japanese War in the Times, arrived at opinions which caused him to dedicate a book of his collected columns to the Emperor of Japan. Nevertheless, the general staffs believed that simply to get the Russian giant in motion, regardless of how he functioned, was all that mattered. This was difficult enough. During mobilization, the average Russian soldier had to be transported 700 miles, 4 times as far as the average German soldier, and Russia had available 1/10 as many railroads per square kilometer as Germany. As a defense against invasion, these had been deliberately built on a wider gauge than those of Germany. Heavy French loans to finance increased railroad construction had not yet accomplished their goal. Equal speed in mobilization was obviously impossible, but even if only half the 800,000 Russian troops promised for the German front could be put in position by the 15th day for a lunge into East Prussia, however faulty their military organization, the effect of their invasion of German territory was expected to be momentous. To send an army into modern battle on enemy territory, especially under the disadvantage of different railway gauges, is a hazardous and complicated undertaking requiring prodigies of careful organization. Systematic attention to detail was not a notable characteristic of the Russian army. The officer corps was top-heavy with a superabundance of aged generals, whose heaviest intellectual exercise was card-playing, and who, to save their court perquisites and prestige, were kept on the active list regardless of activity. Officers were appointed and promoted chiefly through patronage, social or monetary, and although there were among them many brave and able soldiers, the system did not tend to bring the best to the top. Their laziness and lack of interest in outdoor sports dismayed a British military attaché who, on visiting a frontier garrison near the Afghan border, was appalled to find not a single tennis court. In the purges after the Japanese War, large numbers had resigned or been forced out in an effort to loosen the mass clogging the top. In 1 year, 341 generals, nearly as many as in all the French army, and 400 colonels had been retired as inefficient. Yet despite improvements in pay and promotion, there was a shortage in 1913 of 3,000 officers. Much had been done since the Japanese War to clean away the decay in the army, but the Russian regime was still the same. This insane regime, its ablest defender, Count Vitya, the premier of 1903-06, called it, this tangle of cowardice, blindness, craftiness, and stupidity. The regime was ruled from the top by a sovereign who had but one idea of government, to preserve intact the absolute monarchy bequeathed to him by his father, and who, lacking the intellect, energy, or training for his job, fell back on personal favourites, whim, simple mulishness, and other devices of the empty-headed autocrat. His father, Alexander III, who deliberately intended to keep his son uneducated in statecraft until the age of 30, unfortunately miscalculated his own life expectancy and died when Nicholas was 26. The new Tsar, now 46, had learned nothing in the interval, and the impression of imperturbability he conveyed was in reality apathy, the indifference of a mind so shallow as to be all surface. When a telegram was brought to him, announcing the annihilation of the Russian fleet at Tsushima, he read it, stuffed it in his pocket, and went on playing tennis. When the Premier, Kokovtsov, returning from Berlin in November 1913, gave the Tsar a personal report on German preparations for war, Nicholas listened to him with his usual intent, unwavering gaze, looking straight into my eyes. After a long pause, when the Premier had finished, as if waking from a reverie, he said gravely, "God's will be done." In fact, Kokovtsov concluded, he was simply bored. At the bottom, the regime was based upon an ant-heap of secret police who penetrated every ministry, bureau, and provincial department to such a degree that Count Vitya felt obliged each year to deposit the notes and records he was keeping for his memoirs in a bank vault in France for safekeeping. When another premier, Stolypin, was assassinated in 1911, the perpetrators were discovered to be the secret police acting as agents provocateurs to discredit the revolutionists. Between the Tsar and the secret police, the mainstay of the regime were the chinovniki, a class of bureaucrats and officials drawn from the nobility who performed the actual business of government. They were responsible to no constitutional body and subject only to arbitrary recall by the Tsar, who, bent by the winds of court intrigue and his wife's suspicions, exercised it constantly. Under the circumstances, able men did not hold office long, and one who refused it, pleading poor health, inspired a colleague to comment, "In those days everyone was in poor health." Simmering with chronic discontent, Russia in the reign of Nicholas II was harassed by disasters, massacres, military defeats and uprisings, culminating in the Revolution of 1905. When at that time the Tsar was advised by Count Vitya that he must either grant the constitution which the people were demanding or restore order under military dictatorship, he was obliged with bitter distaste to accept the first choice, because his father's cousin, the Grand Duke Nicholas, commander of the St. Petersburg military district, refused to accept responsibility for the second. For this default, the Grand Duke was never forgiven by the Hyper-Bourbons, the Baltic Barons of German blood and sympathy, the Black Hundreds, those anarchists of the right, and other reactionary groups who manned the ramparts of autocracy. They felt, as did many Germans, including the Kaiser in alternate hours, that the common interests of autocracies, formerly linked in the Dreikaiserbund, made Germany a more natural ally of Russia than the democracies of the West. regarding the liberals within Russia as their first enemy, the Russian reactionaries preferred the Kaiser to the Duma, as the French right of a later day were to prefer Hitler to Léon Blum. Only the growing threat of Germany itself, in the last 20 years before the war, induced Tsarist Russia, against her natural inclination, to make alliance with Republican France. Ultimately, the threat even brought her together with England, which for a century had barred her from Constantinople, and of whom one of the Tsar's uncles, the Grand Duke Vladimir Alexandrovich, said in 1898, "I hope to live long enough to hear England's death rattle. That is the ardent prayer I address to God each day." The cohorts of Vladimir dominated a court that was living out its age of Nero, as ladies enjoyed the thrills of afternoon seances with the unwashed Rasputin. But Russia also had its democrats and liberals of the Duma, its Bakunin, the nihilist, its Prince Kropotkin, who became an anarchist, its intelligentsia, of whom the Tsar said, "How I detest that word. I wish I could order the Academy to strike it from the Russian dictionary." Its Levins, who agonized endlessly over their souls, socialism, and the soil. Its Uncle Vanyas, without hope. Its particular quality that caused a British diplomat to conclude that everyone in Russia was a little mad. A quality called le charme slave, half nonchalance, half inefficiency. A kind of fantasiette of fecklessness that hung like a faint mist over the city on the Neva, which the world knew as St. Petersburg, and did not know was the cherry orchard. Insofar as readiness for war was concerned, the regime was personified by its minister for war, General Sukhomlinov, an artful, indolent, pleasure-loving, chubby little man in his 60s, of whom his colleague, Foreign Minister Sazonov, said, "It was very difficult to make him work, but to get him to tell the truth was well-nigh impossible." Having won the Cross of St. George as a dashing young cavalry officer in the War of 1877 against the Turks, Sukhomlinov believed that military knowledge acquired in that campaign was permanent truth. As Minister of War, he scolded a meeting of Staff College instructors for interest in such innovations as the factor of firepower against the sabre, lance, and the bayonet charge. He could not hear the phrase "modern war," he said, without a sense of annoyance. "As war was, so it has remained. All these things are merely vicious innovations. Look at me, for instance. I have not read a military manual for the last 25 years. In 1913, he dismissed 5 instructors of the college who persisted in preaching the vicious heresy of fire tactics. Sukhomlinov's native intelligence was adulterated by levity to cunning and cleverness. He was short and soft, with a cat-like face, neat white whiskers and beard, and an ingratiating, almost feline manner that captivated those like the Tsar whom he set himself to please. In others, like the French ambassador Paleolog, he inspired distrust at first sight. Ministerial office, both appointment and dismissal, being entirely at the whim of the Tsar, Sukhomlinov had won and kept himself in favour by being at once obsequious and entertaining, by funny stories and acts of buffoonery, avoidance of serious and unpleasant matters, and careful cultivation of the friend, Rasputin. As a result, he proved immune to charges of corruption and incompetence, to a sensational divorce scandal, and to an even more resounding spy scandal. Smitten in 1906 by the 23-year-old wife of a provincial governor, Sukhomlinov contrived to get rid of the husband by divorce on framed evidence, and marry the beautiful residue as his 4th wife. Naturally lazy, he now left his work more and more in the hands of subordinates, while, in the words of the French ambassador, keeping all his strength for conjugal pleasures with a wife 32 years younger than himself. Madame Sukhomlinov delighted to order clothes in Paris, dine in expensive restaurants, and give large parties. To gratify her extravagances, Sukhomlinov became an early and successful practitioner of the art of the expense account. He charged the government travelling expenses at the rate of 24 horse versts per diem, while actually making his tours of inspection by railroad. Netting a lucrative balance, augmented by inside knowledge of trends on the stock market, he was able to bank 702,737 rubles, during a six-year period in which his total salary was 270,000 rubles. In this happy exercise, he was aided by an entourage who lent him money in return for military passes, invitations to manoeuvres and other forms of information. One of them, an Austrian named Altschiller, who had supplied the evidence for Madame Sukomlinov's divorce and who was received as an intimate in the minister's home and office, where documents were left lying about, was revealed after his departure in January 1914 to have been Austria's chief agent in Russia. Another was the more notorious Colonel Miosadev, reputed to be Madame Sukomlinov's lover, who, though only chief of railroad police at the frontier, was possessor of 5 German decorations and honoured by the Kaiser with an invitation to lunch at Romintern, the imperial hunting lodge just over the border. Not surprisingly, Colonel Miosadev was suspected of espionage. He was arrested and tried in 1912, but as a result of Sukomlinov's personal intervention, was acquitted and enabled to continue in his former duties up to and through the first year of the war. In 1915, when his protector had finally lost office as a result of Russian reverses, he was rearrested, convicted, and hanged as a spy. Sukomlinov's fortunes after 1914 are significant. He escaped prosecution at the same time as Colonel Miosadev, only through the influence of the Tsar and Tsarina, but ultimately, in August 1917, after the Tsar had abdicated and the provisional government was already crumbling, he too was brought to trial. In the ruin and tumult of that time, he was tried less for treason, which was the nominal charge, than for all the sins of the old regime. In the prosecutor's summing up, those sins came to one, that the Russian people, having been forced to fight without guns or munitions, suffered a loss of confidence in the government which had spread like a plague with terrible consequences. After a month of sensational testimony, in which the details of his financial and amorous peculations were brought out, Sukomlinov was acquitted of treason, but found guilty of abuse of power and inactivity. Sentenced to hard labour for life, he was liberated a few months later by the Bolsheviks, and made his way to Berlin, where he lived until his death in 1926, and where in 1924 he published his memoirs, which he dedicated to the deposed Kaiser. In a preface, he explained that the Russian and German monarchies, having been destroyed as enemies during the war, only the rapprochement of the two countries could restore them to power. This thought so impressed the Hohenzollern exile that he wrote out a dedication of his own memoirs to Sukomlinov, but was apparently dissuaded from using it in the published version. This was the man who was Russia's Minister of War from 1908 to 1914. Embodying as he did the opinions and enjoying the support of the reactionaries, his preparation for war with Germany, which was the ministry's chief task, was something less than wholehearted. He immediately halted the movement for reform of the army, which had made progress since the shame of the Russo-Japanese War. The General Staff, after having been given independence in order to further its study of modern military science, was after 1908 once again subordinated to the Minister of War, who had sole access to the Tsar. Shorn of initiative and power, it found no able leader or even the consistency of a single second-rate one. In the 6 years prior to 1914, 6 different chiefs of staff succeeded each other, with effect upon war plans that was hardly systematic. While Sukomlinov left work to others, he allowed no freedom of ideas. Clinging stubbornly to obsolete theories and ancient glories, he claimed that Russia's past defeats had been due to mistakes of commanding officers, rather than to any inadequacy of training, preparation, or supply. With invincible belief in the bayonet's supremacy over the bullet, he made no effort to build up factories for increased production of shells, rifles, and cartridges. No country, its military critics invariably discover afterward, is ever adequately prepared in munitions. Britain's shell shortage was to become a national scandal. The French shortage of everything from heavy artillery to boots was a scandal before the war began. In Russia, Sukomlinov did not even use up the funds the government appropriated for munitions. Russia began the war with 850 shells per gun, compared to a reserve of 2,000 to 3,000 shells per gun used by the Western armies, although Sir Komlinov himself had agreed in 1912 to a compromise of 1,500 per gun. The Russian infantry division had 7 field gun batteries, compared with 14 in the German division. The whole Russian army had 60 batteries of heavy artillery, compared with 381 in the German army. Warnings that war would be